In their new book, American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson explain how political elites enabled and propelled plutocracy. In their new book, Hacker and Pearson argue that Americans have forgotten what drove the unprecedented prosperity we experienced in the last century, a robust, responsive government that balanced and sometimes worked in tandem with the nimble fingers of the market. In an era of increasing concern about inequality and in an election season where anti-government accusations swirl, the book is a very interesting read, with the author saying at stake is nothing less than the future of prosperity in America. Jacob Hacker is a professor of political science and director of the Institution for Social Policy Studies at Yale University. Paul Pearson is the John Gross Professor of Political Science at the University of California at Berkeley. Again, the name of the book is American Amnesia, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jacob and Paul to the roundtable this morning. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
So, Jacob, let us begin with you as to how this particular project came about.
Some of your listeners may know we wrote a book a few years back on rising inequality in the United States. And when we were done with that book, we started to think more about why it had proved so difficult to have a conversation, not just about inequality, but about the essential role that government plays in ensuring broad-based opportunity and prosperity. And as we started to look into that, we just became fascinated by the sort of forgotten story of how central government was to America's economic rise. I mean, you know, everything from our long life expectancy to our clean air and water to the iPhone that many of us have in our pockets owes an enormous amount to government's regulatory and investment activities. And so we tell the story in America Amnesia of how that happened, how it made the 20th century the richest, most prosperous, most successful American century. And then we obviously are interested in why we've forgotten that and what's happened since. So it's really a story that we think is optimistic because there's so much that's good about the role that government played in the 20th century, but it's also optimistic because we actually think we can recapture that if we understand better why you need an effective government to have a prosperous economy.
Paul, as Jacob just said, that idea of recapturing this. So give us an idea of when the golden age was.
We really think the 20th century as a whole is something that people really need to step back and celebrate. There's just a spectacular increase in the quality of life for almost all Americans. I mean, you can see it in income, you can see it in health and longevity. At the beginning of the 20th century, you know, people lived about 40 years. Now they live 75 or 80 years. You know, it's just extraordinary. The gains in education are extraordinary over this period, and government was central to all that all along the way. I mean, at the beginning of the century, it is getting clean water, particularly in urban areas. If you think about New York City, for example, where infants had a 3 in 10 chance of not reaching their first birthday at the beginning of the century, and you know, the first fundamental step there is cleaning up the water and the milk, and you need government to do that. And it just continues, you know, really all the way through the 20th century. I guess you could say the peak of the golden age is the period around World War II and the 3 decades or so afterwards, where you really did have, I think, the public sector and the private sector, you know, not always in perfect harmony, but really working together with each using its particular strengths to build a stronger and more prosperous society. The expansion of science and education is probably the most central story there. And in the book, we argue that it's really the last 30 years or so, since 40 years, since the late 1970s, that this arrangement has slowly started to erode. And we haven't lost ground in absolute terms. We're a richer society now than we were then. We're a more educated society now than we were then. But the rate of improvement has slowed way down, and a lot of other countries have actually been racing past us.
Jacob, you talk in the book about how this formula wasn't a secret and not even controversial, but the model was a mixed economy. So how do you believe that the amnesia started to take hold?
Well, First, let me just emphasize that point about how this was widely accepted at the time that Paul was talking about. You know, in the World War II period and the 30 years afterwards, there was a lot of controversy over some issues like labor and civil rights, but on this basic idea that government should be playing a huge role in investing in science and infrastructure and encouraging broad-based growth, there was really limited controversy, and moderate Republicans and the business community, particularly some of the more farsighted business leaders of that era, were really on board with the mixed economy. And the way we describe the mixed economy, it's not a story about how government alone makes us richer. It's a story about how government works in tandem with, and sometimes, you know, in opposition to, when necessary, the private sector to encourage growth. We talk about, there's this image from the political economist Charles Lindbloom, where he talks about the fingers of the market and the strong thumb of government working together. And so, you know, in many cases, it was complementary, such as the big investments in science that seeded the computer revolution and the internet. In some cases, it was more oppositional. For example, cleaning up our air required fighting big industries. So did fighting tobacco and smoking and making cars safer. There was a lot of industry opposition in each of these areas. But now when we look back, we think, yeah, that made a lot of sense. And at the time, there was broad-based support for it. So just to sort of give the very basics of what happened, we think that the two main players that kind of held up this mixed economy that have shifted are the business community and Republicans, and basically the kind of moderate Republican leadership that once played a constructive role has disappeared, and we see that disappearance today and what's happening to the Republican Party. And then with business, it's a more complex story, but the business community became much more financialized. Wall Street came to dominate over manufacturing and kind of older line industries that had a more favorable view towards government. And some of the leading business groups, like the Chamber of Commerce and increasingly the network of business associations that is circled around Charles and David Koch, the Koch brothers, those groups have become much more conservative on major economic issues, and in many cases much more parochial as well, looking out for business narrowly as opposed to, you know, American capitalism as a whole.
Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson are the authors of the new book, American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. Paul Pearson, let me ask you, in relation to what Jacob was just saying, you talk in the book about the modern robber barons and how they have filled the vacuum that has been left from debilitated government. Who are those robber barons?
Well, by the modern robber barons, we're basically talking about particular industries that are able to advance their own narrow interests at the expense of the broad population as a whole. And there's more and more political support, unfortunately, for them being able to do that. They're able to draw on a lot of support from the business community, and they're able to draw on support in most cases from the Republican Party and parts of the Democratic Party as well. And the three big ones that we focus on in the book are the fossil fuel industry, Wall Street, and the healthcare industry. And in each case, we argue that they've effectively pushed to limit the role of government in advancing the interests of all Americans and really the interests of long-term prosperity. And they've been able to capture a lot of the financial rewards that really should be distributed towards a broader prosperity and economic growth. Economists call this rent-seeking, that there's a growth of rent-seeking in our economy, and you could look at any of those industries and see really striking ways in which their narrow interests have been advanced, but at a cost to the rest of us.
When you talk about a cost to the rest of us, Jacob, and you spoke about this, and certainly do in the book, about this idea of tearing down government to build up the GOP. So with the current state of the Republican Party, and looking at what is happening now, is it too early to say that we are in a rebuilding mode, or are we still in the are we still in the free fall mode? And is this, as many have suggested over the past several weeks and months, that that the Republican Party is reaping what they have sown over the last several years?
Well, it's certainly the case that they're reaping some of what they've sown. I mean, I don't think a Donald Trump rises in an environment in which people have some faith in the ability of government, and in an environment in which they aren't so dissatisfied with their political leaders and institutions. And, you know, to go back to what Paul was saying about the modern robber barons, I mean, we base this story, the modern robber barons are based on the original robber barons, who were these feudal lords on the Rhine River who would block ships from passing and extract tolls from them. And the reason why I think that's a resonant image today is that the inability of government to act is actually causing us to become poorer. And so we usually think of, you know, government intervention in the economy and the role of corporations in shaping that as being about, you know, crony capitalism. And it's all about kind of special deals that government does. But in fact, it's the inability of government to act that is imposing a lot of costs on us today, like not upgrading our infrastructure or stopping the kinds of investments in research and development that made possible much of the technology that has made our lives so much easier today. Or, you know, to use a case that is looking forward a bit, is that if we don't deal with climate change, we're in deep trouble. And so the Republican Party learned, 25 years ago, I really think that we should see this as happening around the 1990s, and that even as late as 1990, you saw George H.W. Bush working with Democrats to, for example, upgrade the Clean Air Act, which is a law that has probably added maybe 2 years of life expectancy to Americans. And so we saw this in the 1990s with Newt Gingrich, and then Mitch McConnell kind of perfected it, which was basically make government work really poorly, make the Democrats look bad because, you know, they can't handle it, and the Democrats are cross-pressured by a lot of the money that's pouring into politics, so they're pretty ineffectual to begin with. And the result is that people hate government, and they turn to the party that says government doesn't work. And so Republicans have not done great at the presidential level, but they have built a very solid base over this period in the states and in Congress. And even if Donald Trump is the nominee and loses spectacularly, it's not clear to us that that's going to discipline the GOP enough for them to really rethink this basic breaking government to control government strategy.
I want to read one of my favorite lines in the entire book and then ask two questions about it. In discussing this book with different audiences, we have been struck repeatedly by how often thoughtful and informed people slip into describing government as if it were little more than a vehicle for redistribution. Some favor that redistribution, others oppose it. And here's the line. But what is missing is an understanding that most of what government does is not about redistribution at all. It is about addressing a wide range of problems that markets alone are ill-equipped to tackle. So question one, which one of you wrote that?
We have stopped trying to figure out who
okay.
wrote what.
All right.
Our writing process has become so collaborative. Unfortunately, that means that we're not always the best critics of our own work. We just love everything we wrote because we both think that we did it.
Okay, well, I'll give you both credit. It's a great line. So, Jacob, let us talk about it. Why do we have to rethink that and make that such an important distinction?
Well, I'll let Paul take this one up, but I'll just say that it's really striking to us that this problem is both a problem of the right and the left. I've already talked about the right, but with liberals, and you see it with the Bernie Sanders campaign, there is, I think, a lack of appreciation of the many, many aspects of what government does that are not about redistributing income, and that a lot of these things are going to make our economy more prosperous overall, are going to, you know, make everyone better off. So I think not being able to talk about those is a real problem that the left has today. It's a problem that they didn't have a generation ago because so many people, or two generations ago, because so many people took for granted that role. And so Paul can, I think, continue the thought.
Well, I have to say, we think inequality and rising inequality is a huge problem. We wrote a whole book about it. But we do think that there's a danger that people focus exclusively on that and see government as just or primarily a vehicle of redistribution. And when we began working on this book, we discovered very quickly that it was just astonishing the range of activities that government was involved in and had been involved in over the course really of all of American economic history, but especially in the 20th century. And I'll just give one example that I think should be central to how we think about these kinds of questions, which is the development of science and technology. And it's just false. I think economists overwhelmingly are convinced that it is false to think that the key to economic growth is a small circle of job creators who produce growth through their economic investment. Instead, it's the rise of science and knowledge and an educated workforce that can take advantage of that those scientific developments. And government has just been central to the extraordinary rise of the U.S. as a scientific superpower. And you can see, unfortunately, that since 1970, our lead has really eroded, and we're no longer making the kind of fundamental investments that we were in that area. So yes, we're all hugely dependent for prosperity on government, whether we're reliant upon government transfer programs or not.
Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson are our guests. The name of the book is American Amnesia: How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. So, Jacob, let us, in our few remaining moments, talk about what we can do about this and how we bring a coalition together to combat these forces.
Well, that is, of course, the big question. And as I said at the outset, we really do think this book should make people feel optimistic about the prospects for reviving the mixed economy. I'm not sure that you felt that way after reading it, but let me just say why. If you look at the progress over the 20th century that was a result of the strong thumb of government working with the nimble fingers of the market, you see again and again that there's a lot of money on the table, if you will. There are a lot of places where we can all prosper if we can use government effectively. And so government is an enormous partner in the long-term dance of prosperity. And one of the areas in which I think you see this most obviously today is the one that Paul was just talking about, technology and education, right? If we're still reaping the fruits of the investments we made in the past, but if we want to continue to have the kind of advances that led to the iPhone, that led to the internet, that led to almost all modern computing technology, we're going to have to make investments today. And the same is true in infrastructure. The same is true in continuing to improve our air and water quality, an area where we've added years to the American lifespan, and we could add years in the future. And so it's really a political problem that we're facing. And the political problem can be boiled down most simply to the problem that I mentioned earlier, that those two pillars that held up the mixed economy, the business community and the moderate GOP, have both eroded substantially. And so Paul, I think, can talk a little bit more about how we might get the business elite more engaged and how we might bring back some of the trust in government that's so eroded due to the sort of spiral of a dissatisfaction that's been unleashed by recent attacks on government.
How do we do it, Paul?
Well, I think it's going to be a long road, sadly. And I actually think the place that we have to start is by changing the conversation. That really, in a lot of ways, this is a battle of ideas. And I think a terrible problem has been that we have stopped articulating the case for government. And of course, none of this is to say that government is perfect. Government does all sorts of things wrong. And the more that we distrust it and the more alienated we are, the more likely it is it's going to do things wrong. And so increasingly politicians don't defend it because they think that that's going to be unpopular. They defend particular programs. And so the first step, I think, is to just encourage people to really take a step back and look and to recognize all the things that government does. And so for those who are open to that kind of idea, I think the first step is really to begin that struggle over ideas the way that conservatives launched, a move in the other direction 40 years ago to essentially, tear down government and to argue that markets were the solution to all our problems. And I really think that the first order of business is to try to change that conversation and to help people see that government needs to be improved rather than dismantled.
You talk about in the book, at the end of the book, about reframing that conversation, but also a lot of this is getting rid of the cynicism, which is a hard thing, especially if you've been screwed by the system.
It is a hard thing. And you know, we're not asking people to accept on faith that government's going to start working overnight, but we do want people to remember that there are things that government can do that markets can't, and that government working together with markets is what brought us our prosperity. So I think one of the things that we really think is important for people to understand is that it's the breakdown of our political system that has really, you know, caused a lot of the distrust and the sort of vicious cycle that has fed it. And that if we could get people more engaged electorally, so getting more people out to vote, so putting pressure, especially on politicians who are trying to stop things from happening, putting more pressure on them for positive action. If we could make Congress a bit more streamlined, a bit more capable of acting, and if we could reduce some of the sway of money, that's all going to sort of tilt the balance in the system in ways that's going to push us in the direction of a kind of positive spiral. But as Paul was saying, the critical ingredient, and that will emerge out of this, we think, is that we need to get some far-sighted leaders in the business community and elsewhere who are willing to stand up and say, yes, we need government. I mean, I just spent the last week or so thinking about Andy Grove's life. He passed away last week.
Right.
And, you know, he was a remarkable product of this mid-20th century mixed economy. I mean, he went to a public college in New York. He went to UC Berkeley. He went to Silicon Valley, and he started at a firm that was basically producing semiconductors and transistors for the Defense Department and NASA. And he, throughout his life, argued that you needed to have this kind of basic foundation. I mean, all these technologists were skeptical of the idea that government could, like, manage the economy, but they all understood you needed to have that government foundation. And right now in Silicon Valley, you don't see that. You don't hear that. You don't hear it from many of the big business associations. As I said, the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce, they're talking trash about government all the time. But if there are people out there, people like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or maybe even Michael Bloomberg, who clearly recognize something's gone awry, and we need them to step up and speak to this. So if we can start this conversation in the right direction, if we can create some of the pressure on politicians to behave more responsibly, and we can get some of these elites engaged, I really do feel like we can turn the tide and start using government effectively again.
Jacob Hacker is a professor of political science and director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale University. Paul Pearson is the John Gross Professor of Political Science at the University of California at Berkeley. Their new book, American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Gentlemen, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for talking about this very important topic.
Thank you so much.
A great
Thanks,
pleasure.
Joe.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book is American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.